Today is the day that you have been waiting for. The final official episode of season two of this merry adventure that we've been on. Because you watched
Whoosh!
Star Crash, Dr. Alan Barris, Michael Klink, and me, Mike Vanderpool, all nerds from different herds, here today to talk about a film, Buckaroo Banzai. Actually, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension is, I think, the official title.
Yes.
A movie that I probably would have liked as a kid, don't really understand now as an adult. But this culminates, this is the culmination of our season two regarding superhero films. We've put a lot of hypotheses out there. We've come to no conclusions. I don't think we'll get to any conclusions today, but you know, every ending is a new beginning, as they say. So how should we end this season two?
Now, you did have a surprise recommendation that you wanted to drop on us.
Yes.
So I'm remind you that that is coming. So you need to drop that upon us by the end of the episode
today. Yes, an indecent proposal, as you said, which is really scary.
Thank you for that French tickler. I mean, tease. I mean,
wow.
Let's just clap during the whole freaking thing today, folks. I don't care anymore. Yes, so I will be teasing, or I actually at the end of today's episode I will be making a indecent proposal to my fellow cinema files, and we will make a decision on whether or not we will do something after as a bonus episode. I've got an idea for a bonus episode. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay. Well, I'm already gonna say yes, so
then I'm gonna change my request if it's already in for sure yes. That Alan will be wearing a variety of outfits. multiple costume changes for Alan as we go through the progression of Jean Grey as Miss Marvel and all of her
incarnations. At least you didn't say Emma Frost.
I don't know who that is.
Oh, that's the white queen.
All right, so Buckaroo Banzai is a W.D. Richter produced and directed by him. I haven't done much digging into this. I know it's a movie. I know it's got a lot of famous people in it, a lot of names, a lot of faces you recognize. Maybe not as many names, but faces for sure.
Definitely.
And the connection to last episode, you know, Peter Weller as the main character in this and RoboCop is pretty cool. 80s shoulder pads play a big prominent role in this movie. It
seems like the most 80s movie that ever 80s. It just it feels very 80s.
Yes.
So my thing today, and I think the way that we go through this is you guys explaining to me what the freak I just watched, because I don't understand any of it. So you guys talk more than me, and everybody will be better off.
All right, let me give you the key that will gradually help unlock this. There are two things you must bear in mind. Number one, this is a homage / parody / I don't even know what of a comic book, pulp fiction, I think even movie and radio on occasion, a character named Doc Savage. Now, Doc Savage is very similar to our hero here, Buckaroo Banzai, because, he's huge. So there's a difference. He's the man of bronze. He is a large, muscular dude who also happens to be a super genius and has mastered a whole bunch of different disciplines in his life. And he also has a pile of pals who help him on his adventures. So that's where we get the core of this. Buckaroo Banzai is Doc Savage. And a more modern connection to that, by the way, if you've seen the Venture Brothers, while the core of the Venture Brothers is a parody of Johnny Quest, the elder Dr. Venture is Doc Savage. He's got a group of henchmen who follow him around, and he's totally Doc Savage, and he's pretty much perfect, except he has a shocking disregard for his child. But other than that, Doc Savage. Now, the other thing you have to remember that this is 1984, and this is right in the smack middle of the golden age of the WTF movie. Now, the ones that always come to mind here, and I'm certain you guys can help me remember some others.
Everything that Jeff Goldblum is in?
Well, yes. But the perfect example of this is Repo Man. A movie that is entirely driven by its awesome soundtrack. But it's also got all this other crazy crap going on in it, and it makes no sense whatsoever. But it's still really fun. It still really actually works. The other one, I'm thinking Brazil, which is not a fun movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it is also a document to just weirdness. It is a visionary, just crazy movie. And the 80s were the golden age of these things. Really now the only truly visionary stuff that's coming out is relegated to horror. In some cases, sci-fi. I guess we'll see whether the remake of Dune is going to be pretty good. That might be a beer and a WTF movie for the modern age. But it's the 80s. And some movies in the 80s were just made because
of cocaine.
And there you go. And you're off and running. And it might be cocaine, it might be craziness, it might be just an insane love of just the weird and the comic booky, but there you go. So that's your key. It makes sense.
Because I really do, I mean, this is feels like it's paying homage and riffing out a lot of stuff, right? Like 80s riffed on 50s. And there's a lot of that going on within some of the styling. You know, Buckaroo wearing his haircut, his greasy, whatever, dovetail-looking outsider's haircut going on there in some of the stuff. Wardrobe across the board is very, very 80s, but 80s as a reference to 50s, I think, culture.
Yes, a lot of ways.
And then obviously the tie-in to the H.G. Wells, War of the Worlds. This thing seems to be riffing on everything, right? And maybe that's where I'm totally confused, because it's like I'm looking for a common point, and it's like there is no common point of reference.
It's just weird, and as a result, it's fun. You just have to go with it.
I would say though, the successful version of what some of the other movies that we've seen that have tried to do this, like Galaxy Lords, let's say, it tried to spoof on things. And I'm bringing this up, and it's a bad movie, okay?
Oh, okay.
but Bucker Banzai succeeds in that because it actually has a somewhat cohesive story. Like, it's not just kind of this all over the place stuff. Yeah, there are random things like a watermelon randomly coming up, but other than that, it's mainly got a basic thread of a story with all these different things that it's pulling from.
I think that's how it starts out, right? It doesn't start out very weird. It starts out fairly traditional, right? Like who he is, like, okay, so he's a doctor and a astronaut-y whatever he's got going on there, but that's one character, one thing that we're introduced to, right?
And a music, don't forget the Hong Kong Cavaliers as a band.
But that doesn't happen until after we firmly established him as a superhero and John Lithgow's character as the villain, and then the connection between the two, right? Before we get into too much craziness, good and bad are established, and where they're going to collide is established. Then the love interest is brought in, and then in my mind, it's very much a traditional superhero film, at least as it starts.
I would say throughout. Because he has to make the choice between the Earth or the one he loves, too.
Dilemma of choice, yes.
So this movie has a crazy regular car that's been souped up and weird looking with vents in the back. It's got a crazy wild-haired scientist and Christopher Lloyd. It's crazy.
and Christopher Lloyd. The easy connection, of course. Yeah. It also has a device that bears a strong resemblance to a flux capacitor in it as a key item. There you go.
I did not say Back to the Future or flux capacitor.
So wait, when did Back to the Future come out?
85.
Oh, so Back to the Future stole from Buckaroo Banzai?
Did it steal?
So Christopher Lloyd pretty much came, hey, look, I've got some ideas on what we can do in this new movie.
Well, actually, I will say they spent about, a year shopping around Back to the Future to different studios before they finally landed on.
That's the story.
Yes, that's the story. Yeah. Which I would say the opening crawl isn't necessary. They could have done Rear Window or Back to the Future opening where they just panned over things instead of just having the camera set on sandbags in the beginning and just panning over the sandbags. They could have done something else and had it kind of the story flow a little bit better.
But I think, though, is that an homage to the whole serial type thing where some of this is born from, right?
Yeah.
And comics. This is intended to be like a comic book universe too.
Yeah. Yeah. And why are they also sweaty?
Because it's hot outside.
Did you notice that? They're like always got this sheen on them.
Yeah. Well, if wet roads are more visually pleasing on film, then wet skin is more visually pleasing. I don't know. Is it?
So to distract from that potentially uncomfortable direction we were going, if you might have noticed the license plate of the rocket car, it is Rocket 88, which is a reference to the first rock and roll song.
Really?
That is the song. That is a rock and roll song recorded by Ike Turner and his band at the time, before Tina came into the picture.
Really?
It is not, by the way, as some rock historians have argued in error, that it is not actually Bill Haley and his Comets' Rock Around the Clock, which was the theme song to the first season of Happy Days. That is not the first rock and roll song. Whitey stole rock and roll. Again, it was Ike Turner who, again, was the one who really innovated it. He's a terrible human, but you still got to give him his due.
You take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and there you have the facts of life.
The facts of life?
There you go.
Which facts of life character would you be, Clink? Did we go over this last week?
I don't think so, did we?
I can't remember what we devolved into last week, but I'm pretty sure, like...
It's been so long since I've seen that show.
One of my podcasts, we had a discussion about whether or not which character you were from that. And I think I picked George Clooney. and you were Tootie.
Not Tootie.
I don't know, dude.
I know I'm not Joe. I know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. To be Joe, the obnoxious one. So.
So lots of amazing actors, bit part actors, right? Character actors throughout this whole thing. And I'm even trying to place some of them. Who's the alien?
So let's run down right from the beginning. John Lithgow, amazing. And of course, as a Dexter fan, they're Vanderpool.
Yeah.
Lithgow's the best thing about the show. He's totally amazing in it. Because he did crazy-ass roles like this that makes his turn on Dexter just so damn good. He's just so terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. So Christopher Lloyd. John Big Boutte, you have to say it right.
Yes.
Boutte.
Then we've got Clancy Brown, a.k.a. the Kurgan, a.k.a. the voice actor for Mr. Krabs on SpongeBob SquarePants.
He does a lot of other stuff, too. Better.
Oh, that. Yeah, that was the dude I didn't... Oh, he's the prison guard in The Shank.
Yeah.
In the Shawshank Redemption.
Oh,
prison guard. That's where I remember him primarily from.
He also did the voice of the Red Death, if I remember right, on the Venture Brothers. So there you go, another Venture Brothers.
Yeah, today. I missed that.
So Clancy Brown is amazing. He's incredible, and he plays Rawhide, the guy who dies, and then comes back for the marching around scene at the end because, well, you got to come back for the marching around scene at the end. Then we have Jeff Goldblum as New Jersey. who is probably the closest that we've got here to an audience surrogate. And I had to look this up on TV Tropes because I was trying to remember what they call the Kitty Pryde character, the person who has been brought in to join the team. And they kind of get talked into it and they have the same questions we do. He's kind of that character here, although he kind of stops being that because he apparently just embraces the weird almost immediately. And other than asking a few questions like, what's with the watermelon? That's about it. I mean, he adapts to the weird very quickly. So I did not know Lewis Smith, who plays Perfect Tommy.
Yeah.
Who the best outfits in this. I love Perfect Tommy. I have a buddy from college whose entire goal in life was to become Perfect Tommy. And unfortunately, but he came pretty close to it.
Where? Because yeah, I recognize something. He's got that. He's in something. Melrose Place. He was in there only two episodes, though. I'm going to assume there. Sorry.
A few. Let's see. Then we've got Ellen Barkin as Penny,
or Peggy,
or whoever we want to call her. Yes, Peggy. and we also have. The guy who really surprised me here, because I don't think I'd noticed he was in it before, is Vincent Schiavelli. Now, he is a bit part actor who's been in, like, everything.
Yeah.
The thing I remember him best from, because I just think he just totally kills it, if you remember the episode of The X-Files where the Jim Rose Circus appears as guest stars. It's one of the best episodes. It's the one where Scully eats the cricket. And if I remember right, actually, Gillian Anderson actually did eat the cricket because she couldn't actually do the sleight of hand that Scully is supposed to do in that. But he plays Lenny in that, who is half of a Siamese twin pairing. And it turns out, well, okay, I'm not going to spoil it because it's the best X-Files episode. The best standalone one, definitely. But he plays Lenny, who is in that. And again, amazing.
I can't remember him. I mean, I remember him, but he's in Better Off Dead, one of my favorite 80s movies. He's also in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Nice.
Something else. Yeah, but he's all One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He's all over. Right. He's got that look where you can't miss him. Yeah.
I forgot he was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I vaguely remember him in that.
That was one of his first films. That was his sixth film was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah. And then also Yakov Smirnov, who actually appears as National Security Advisor Smirnov in AC. So there you go. I think that's the rundown of the heavy hitters for me.
You've got, is it Dan Hedaya? Is he who the one of the actors from The Hurricane is in this? Plays a police officer in that movie. Yeah, you watch Buckaroo Banzai, you're gonna be like, oh yeah, I've seen this person over and over and over, yeah, all over the place. So not really a lot of star power, but definitely a lot of recognizable faces.
Oh, I know that cool guy from that thing, pretty much how most people know Peter Weller. So it was that guy from RoboCop the guy from Buckaroo Banzai, which is how I'm pretty sure he got the job for RoboCop.
Now, if I ever meet any of the stars of this movie, and I know like Christopher Lloyd, and I know that there are stars in other bigger movies, I want to go up to them and say, hey, I loved you, or I loved you in your best role, which was in Buckaroo Banzai, just because it's an awesome movie.
They need to get their appropriate attention, especially since it was such a bomb. Yeah. And which is really sad because I bet the sequel would have been awesome. That's the credit at the end, the Buckaroo Banzai Against the World Crime League, which is just, that's so cool.
I do have a feeling, though, that it was going to be like History of the World Part 1, where Part 2 was a joke as well.
Right, you know,
it wasn't actually going to be made.
I
feel like where this movie falls down with regards to a sequel or its success at the box office, whether it was made for $17 million and made $6 million at the box office, right?
Oh, wow.
Probably because the same issue I'm having. I don't even know how to describe this to somebody else. You know, and word of mouth being such a big part of making people go see things, like, hey, come watch this weird movie. Well, what's it about? It's about this stuff and things and aliens and rock and roll. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to stay home and go watch something else.
And
I'm going to go to the video store.
The high concept of this is, let's do Doc Savage for the 80s. But nobody knew who the hell Doc Savage was at this point. I don't even think people were really reading any of the old Doc Savage things until probably later in the 80s, if that. I think there was actually probably a resurgence in Doc Savage stuff because of the weirdness of this movie. So, there's definitely a high concept here.
Where did this movie come from? This was just a movie, right? That led to the, like, there's a novel, obviously, but that's a novelization.
Yeah.
I'm assuming some comics came out
in an
adaptation.
Which is actually Bucker Banzai is part of the Marvel comic line in the universe.
Yep.
Right on. Huh. So yeah. So this is the birth or afterbirth of some things.
So Yo-Yo Dine shows up here as a company, and I'm trying to remember. I think that's in Thomas Pynchon's work. I want to say it's Crying a Lot 49, because that's the only thing in Pynchon's catalog that I've actually read.
This is the fake movie company or company in a movie that has the last part of the name is Dine, like Cyberdyne.
Yep.
What's Dine?
It's a reference to a real world company, and I cannot remember. I can't remember what it is. The IMDb mentions it. And
so a dyne is a unit of force that, acting on a mass of 1 gram, increases its velocity by 1 centimeter per second every second along the direction that it acts.
Ooh.
So it's a physics term that obviously some company then took, and then movies said, hey, that's cool.
And it's a rocket company of some variety.
Sensodyne's a toothpaste.
Yeah.
My grandma used to use that.
I use that because my teeth are terrible. Rocketdyne was a major defense industry contractor and manufacturer of rocket engines, founded just after World War II to reverse engineer German V2 rockets. Also, again, it's from Pynchon.
And it's derived from the Greek dynamis, meaning power or force.
There we go.
So write that down. So when we ask, what did you learn today? That's what we learned.
We learned what a dime was.
This movie's crazy though. I think what's awesome is it just accepts its absurdity so well. And I don't think that the actors have done, and the acting's it's well acted. Nobody feels out of place here.
For the love interest,
love interest is the weirdest part of this movie, actually, because we never get the full deal. Like, what is the connection between these two? And
we got the connection.
The twin sister, right?
Yeah, twin sister of his ex-wife / dead wife. We think maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. See, that's the tricky part.
I think that she's just there so that what's his name, Buckaroo Banzai, is seen as a heterosexual instead of a homosexual.
Because when
they're all coming together, I thought they were going to break out into YMCA. Like, that just is the feeling I had. Very much Village People ish. Like what Goldblum is wearing and what they're all wearing.
I do love how he meets Penny. He's doing a full on rock concert, stops and goes, "Is everybody having a good time?"
He's an empath.
I absolutely love that scene. It's so crazy and awesome.
Because what is that little trumpet he brings out? That's not a cornet. Like, what's the name of the half trumpet thing?
I don't know.
The fake trumpet is what it is.
Clink, did you go through and list out his superpowers as you do in other films, or did you get lazy on it?
He doesn't have any superpowers. The aliens do.
Well, he's an empath.
Is he? He's probably just very good at hearing. Like, he's probably really attuned. So he's crying.
Is that his superpower then?
He's very sensitive, as well as being really smart.
Okay, he could be somewhat of... You say empath, though. I'm thinking of Deanna Troi from Star Trek, where she can actually perceive emotions like that, not...
It's more reflexive for him.
Mm. Yes.
Okay.
But he is charismatic,
so there's that, too. There's the fact that he's just got this gigantic organization. He actually has three organizations in this. There's levels of his followers. And I am unfamiliar of anybody who has that level of organization backing them up in a movie. He's got his core group, which is the Hong Kong Cavaliers. Then he's got Team Banzai, which is more around him and helping him with the car. And then he's got a whole auxiliary corps of the Blue Blazer regulars.
Which the Blue Blazer, actually, then after that would be the kind of the fan club, because you have that kid.
Yep.
Which I would suggest that would just be like a fan club when the kid's just kind of playing around, and then all of a sudden, randomly, Buckaroo Banzai needs help.
Right. And he can call on his auxiliary, and Buckaroo's in trouble, and bam, they're there. I just love the feeling of all that. That again, it's very 50s kids kind of fantasy of helping out the Lone Ranger or helping out Little Orphan Annie by determining what the Ovaltine code was.
Yeah, but I mean, I could see the whole kid fantasy because he takes the kid on the mission, gives the kid a live gun.
AK-47.
Yeah,
but in the 80s, that's what you did. You gave the kid the gun. I mean, Cloak and Dagger, I think they give him, right? I mean,
this is similar to Anakin in Episode 1 taking the Starfighter up and blowing up all those things. And
Yeah. So. Again, it's the kid finally becoming part of the pulp story.
I think another movie within this universe would fall apart. I think the one movie is good because we have so many questions, and it's one of those things where if you answer any of the questions, it kind of loses its appeal.
Yeah.
I still think they could have pulled it off. But
I mean, I want to see another movie, but yeah.
It wouldn't have been as good.
It's interesting that the three groups or whatever that you mentioned, Alan, I can't remember the word that you used for them, but it's very much this film is all about the cult of personality that really came up in this 80s period, right? Of one person, like he's almost like a Ferris Bueller, right? Like super just because he's cool.
Right.
That's
genius, but still.
That's something that really came out in the 80s. You know, one person.
It is super charisma. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so he's a brain surgeon, world renowned. He's a renowned physicist then too. A rock star, and I want to say there was something else too.
Well, the pilot.
Oh, he's a martial artist.
Martial artist. Oh, yes.
I don't remember if he actually uses it at any point, but yes, he is also a talented martial artist.
The guy, what's the guy with the name with the shirt who doesn't wear the shirt at the end?
Perfect Tommy.
He looks like Laszlo from Real Genius. I don't think that's him though. That's where my brain wants to go.
He looks like Val Kilmer to a little bit. He looks like
Val Kilmer.
Oh no. Period. Val Kilmer. He looks like that.
And then you've got the guy from Outkast in this movie, Andre 3000.
No, that's Lovely. What's his name? That's not Andre 3000.
I bet it looks like
him. Like four then.
Yeah, exactly.
What's his name? Oh, crap. Hold on. His name is Carl Lubley. He was in, was he in Mantis? Alan?
Was Mantis? It,
was wow. it Mantis or Steel?
I don't remember. I looked really briefly and then flashed, didn't recognize any of the stuff he was in.
So I'm wondering if this is a design thing, Clink. Maybe you can help me with some art nonsense. His posse, Buckaroo Banzai's posse, they all really stand out for me, I think because of some of the costuming, right? Except for all of the white guys, except for Pretty Boy. I have a hard time differentiating who's who and what's what. But like, obviously, you know, whatever Goldblum's ethnicity is, his wardrobe, his glasses, his height separates him out. Yeah. African-American, obviously, through color separate out. Same thing with some of the other ethnicities in this film. But like the three or four white folks that are left all just kind of blur, and there's no real differentiation of those characters. I just thought that was interesting because all the other ones are so clearly like characterized with.
Well, of his core group, I think the core group are the ones that have the very dramatic differences in wardrobe and tone. Like Reno, when he goes to battle, he's got those squiggly lines and those two teardrops under his eyes. Jeff Goldblum, yeah, has the full-on, not authentic cowboy, yeah. Which doesn't explain at all. It just shows up.
I think, though, this is a little bit about the romanticizing of all of the things that the 80s were doing of the 50s, of all those things, right? That was what a 50s cowboy – he's dressed like a cowboy character that would come to your kid's birthday party, not like an authentic cowboy.
Yeah. Yeah. But then I think there's one guy, the guy that was at the computer doing the coding with the kind of bigger hair, he didn't really stand out as much. Everybody else kind of did. They had very 80s clothing on, especially like Perfect Tommy, which he had those shoulder pads like crazy the last part. And the way he's walking too is very model-like. It just seems like most of the core group were stood out with wardrobe, just to kind of make themselves separate from the lower peons of the second tier.
So they were the first. Right. Like Team Bonsai kind of group, yeah.
I just wish this movie would hold my attention, because I think I would enjoy it if I actually could focus on it.
Take your medication and then watch it.
It goes... That's a lot to go. Yeah, so this is what? This is a 50 plus 50. What is that? It's an hour and 40-minute movie. It's probably a little too long.
I would agree with. I think that they could have tightened it up a little bit.
They could have taken out the whole love story thing, I think.
Well, they also could have taken out... They could have taken out a lot of the stuff with the president and like the... Although, again, it's... More of the Buckaroo Banzai is so important that he has the ear of the president and all of that. Yeah. But that's not developed terribly well.
Yeah, this movie definitely, and you know, back to my original point of why it maybe wasn't as successful, it they warn you of double mumbo jumbo in screenwriting. This has mumbo jumbo bumbo dumbo lumbo quadruple craziness going on.
Right, right.
Wait, it's, so you have that, but then you have like techno babble for Star Trek, say. What's
the
difference between mumbo jumbo babble and then techno babble that Star Trek uses?
Well, that's a genre expectation too. That breaks when you have an expectation for a genre, you can use that and it overrides the usual screenplay advice. For the most part.
Yeah, this just has, I mean, this feels like a sci-fi time travel movie. It's got horror stuff going on. It's just too many genres colliding here that make it difficult to articulate what it is to somebody else, which I think is part of why it wasn't successful.
Which is the whole point.
Yeah.
But again, tell
that to the investors.
Right, they're not going to be happy with this.
Yeah.
A little bit of trivia. And I found this out through IMDb again, the lazy podcaster's friend. So the end marching scene, the music wasn't done yet at that point. So it turns out the composer said, well, there's another piece of music you can use instead. So they are marching around to the melodious strains of Billy Joel's Uptown Girl.
Nice. That is a great walking song if you've ever...
It works, too. If you watch the scene, it just works perfectly, actually. So, there you go.
What's with the bubble wrap glasses? I'm on that scene right now.
Like, so I can see the hologram.
Yeah, it's just weird.
Oh, I love it.
What's missing from, it seems like nowadays sci-fi, we have all this technology, 3D printing, we can computer compose everything and then 3D print it and then mass produce it for movies. Back then, they didn't have all that technology. So they took found things and put them together and made it look like, oh, hey, you know, like the car, which is a Ford pickup truck, or the DeLorean with all the stuff on it, or these glasses, which are not bubble wrap, but bubble wrap. They're something else.
No, they look like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not uniform. They're all cut out differently. I mean, they're the same. They're similar shape, but like you could tell that they were cut with scissors by like a kid's second grade kid's project.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like that. That's the one of the reasons that Star Wars has the really. I'm thinking of the original movies have their very look too, because the models were all kit bashed. They're stuff that's pasted together, and MST3K makes fun of this on the Satellite of Love set, because they've got toys like on the wall and all kinds of other stuff that they've just spray painted and put on the wall.
It's rather unfortunate, I guess, that when you try to compare Star Wars and Star Trek early stuff to similar things from the period, how all of the Star Wars and Star Trek stuff has been remastered to where that doesn't look like it actually looked when this stuff first came out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But and there was nothing wrong when it came out is the thing. It worked. It worked really well. And then, now with TV being different. TV
so technology. If we're going to make a sci-fi movie, we need big buttons and we need one of those globes that shoots electricity when you touch it.
Yes. No. And flashing lights randomly flashing in the background. And then we have to have somebody make them flash in order. Because that's what you do. People walking from one side of the bridge to another.
All right. Yes, that is good.
This has some Space Raiders stuff going on in it, right? Like the whole team part of Space Raiders, and where the one person in Space Raiders died reminded me of, or I was reminded of that when this guy died in here.
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of sorry.
Seven professionals Western kind of feel too. Oh, so I promised a review of superheroes as they developed over the years. And because I wanted, I ended up looking up when Doc Savage was actually created, because I wanted to find out if the Shadow was before Doc Savage. Because the Shadow has a team of helpers too, and I wanted to figure out which came first, and I still haven't answered that question, because I think the Shadow's helpers actually came later on. But it turns out that we have a surprising superhero origin. So the Doc Savage was created in 1933. The Shadow was created in 1930. So going back a little bit further, we already established that Zorro was created in 1919.
Mm-hmm.
So we were treating Zorro as if he is the origin of sort of the modern superhero thing.
Right.
Now, elements of the superhero, obviously, that go back further than that. We've got all kinds of stories about, like, Hercules and other people with powers. But
Samson.
The origin point for the secret identity tied in with being a vigilante, tied in with being a champion of good, is the Scarlet Pimpernel from 1903.
I think they tried to get me to read that once in some.
They probably tried.
Class.
I think it would have been disappointing. It's especially disappointing from a modern standpoint, because as far as I'm concerned, he's trying to help the bad guys. His entire, apparently the Scarlet Pimpernel's deal, and he's a fop who is in disguise. He is an English nobleman who is trying to help French noblemen escape the guillotine. And for the most part, I'm okay with the guillotine getting a few of these people. So it's one rich guy helping some other rich guys. Now I can see why somebody in 1903 England would think that was a noble cause. But for us in the United States, looking back on this from a modern standpoint, it's like, maybe you should be helping people who, you know, aren't filthy rich.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that is the one thing, right? Like, how do we identify, or what are we calling the modern era of these heroes, right? Because we could, there's obviously probably some bits and pieces of from mythology, from biblical stuff, from even Robin Hood, right? I mean, in some of these other characters. But like, you know, when we think about mass media, these characters and what it's evolved into, right? Like, if we think about where all this thing stuff came from and where it is now with Avengers and now all these blockbuster movies are pretty much all these superhero stories. It's interesting to think about that origin there.
Yeah. So we've got the Scarlet Pimpernel as the first secret identity Avenger of Injustices. Talented sword fighter. Again, very much in still the Zorro vein.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have...
But pre-Zorro.
Yep, a little bit before. So 1903, Zorro's 1919, The Shadow's 1930, Doc Savage is 1933, The Phantom, who we did not get to this season, but at some point, I want you guys to watch it, because I watched it on one of my plane rides, and it was actually kind of entertaining. Not a great movie, but still fun.
Is that the Billy Zane movie, or are there two? Okay. Yep.
Wait, so The Shadow's the Alec Baldwin winner, right?
Yep. And they're about the same. Yeah, they're about the same, really. Same quality, same weird 90s attempt to dress a pulp hero. And really, that 90s affinity for pulp stuff really didn't pay off until The Mummy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, back to the 80s, it was Indiana Jones, going back to kind of storyline. So then we have the two heavy hitters who really create the modern pattern, and that is Superman in 1938, and then we get Batman in 1939. And Batman really starts off as kind of an extension of the whole Shadow thing. Yeah. And
just guns and everything.
Yep. And they're pretty much right down to it.
Yeah.
And but Superman's really the one that sets... We always assume that Superman is the first superhero. But again, I think the argument can be that Scarlet Pimpernel is actually the first who sets the pattern.
Superman, is he the first otherworldly
hero? Yes. He's the first alien out of the batch that I'm
sure that there's got to be other ones around that time that, or even prior to that, that just didn't get as popular, right? I mean, that's just how the world works. But yeah,
well,
everybody else, that's the differentiator, is when Superman is the one that introduced the wider universe of potential superheroes other than Earth.
Yeah.
And also, clearly supernatural powers, too. Also, mm-hmm. somebody who clearly is beyond regular people.
Yes.
Yeah, because I think even if you know, and I said Samson kind of jokingly, but even if you look at Samson, right, like his strength, and even Hercules, their strength, we could always envision like strongman contests, and those people can do things that most normal people can't, right? But heat rays coming out of your eyes and the ability to do all these other things, I think it had to be Superman, right? Like Superman really...
Redirect a river, but anyway.
Yeah, and Hercules lifted up the sky.
Well, yeah, okay. But you know what I mean? Like, that's... Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And even when Superman came out, it was so popular that they had a lot of copycat heroes come out, too, that a lot of them didn't make it, but Captain Marvel, later Shazam, was more popular, actually. So, yeah,
so,
you have a lot of copycatting.
So here's another criterion that we might want to consider, too. What makes, say, Superman different from Hercules? And I would argue that what makes the difference is the modern setting. For the most part, superheroes are contemporary. Now, you get stuff...
Hercules is contemporary.
Well, not really, because...
He's in the Marvel Universe.
Well,
he's on the event.
So is Porky Pig, or whatever, not Porky Pig, Peter Porker.
I am referring to Heracles. the ancient Greeks were sharing the legends of their heroes. Their heroes were always from the past, and usually from some kind of golden age prior to modern people. They were always, things were better back then, and now we're a bunch of candy asses. So for the superhero, there's never that that idea of they're from the good old days when men were men and everybody was able to, there were true heroes among us. They're in the present for the most part. Now we do get some retro superheroes like the Shadow or the Phantom in their treatments. But for the most part, they're happening now. Their stories are in the now.
According to Sirota in Back to Our Future, right, talking about the 80s and some of the stuff that came out, like that was that romanticization of what the 50s were, and that one person bucking the system or going against authority to get stuff done because the government couldn't, whatever it was. I think that kind of feels like, while it was using modern or people of the time or of the time of the real world in the cinema time, it was also like looking back at what the romanticized version of what it meant to be a man or a hero was from the 50s.
All this talk about this though kind of reinforces, you know, Superman says, the S is a symbol for hope, and Superman's kind of the symbol for hope. That, Alan, when you were talking about how the golden age was in the past always for the Greeks, that hope seems a little bit more,
American.
Well, no, it seems more present now, because if Hercules was in the golden age and everything was better back then, you have this Hercules, more than Hercules type character now, that's set now. And from that setting now, it's like, okay, maybe we're not so bad. Maybe we're not in a bad time right now. We got this dude flying around that's a god. He's not murdering us all. He's actually helping us. Maybe this is a good time to be alive.
Well, then again, there's also always the point towards the future, too. That's why so many of our superheroes are super scientists. Yeah. And on top of that, we get Superman referred to as the Man of Tomorrow. This idea that he is sort of a projection of what might be to come.
And again, there's that hope with Star Trek too. Is a show about the future set in our time ish, not really, but it's a story of hope for the future. In the future, we won't have money. In the future, we won't have poverty. In the future, we won't have murder.
We won't care if people are bald.
Exactly.
That's a true story.
Who's
telling that? Yeah. All I know is Buckaroo Banzai, he's got some swag.
Yeah.
Like he's, you know what I mean? He had some stickers and some gear going on all over the place, huh?
Yep.
Totally derailing the conversation we were just having. That was really intellectual. Here's me talking about stickers.
I didn't understand the advertisement on his rocket car. Rich and Monroe car company stickers on his rocket car. Who's going to see this rocket car?
Good question.
MUNROE.
Yeah.
That Monroe. Well, if a picture ended up in Popular Mechanics or Popular Science,
that might be it.
Because I thought this was all like a top secret experiment, and all of a sudden you have B.F. Goodrich.
Oh, no Ford truck could ever go that fast and stay together. Okay, I'm sorry. No offense, Ford, but that's not how aero works.
All offense, Ford. Ford cars back then were horrible.
All offense. Yeah.
Yes. And again, I know I keep bringing you back to this, and I kind of apologize for this one, but with the DeLorean in Back to the Future, they even kind of make fun of the DeLorean in the movie. Like, the DeLorean wasn't a great car to be running, and there are times when it runs out, obviously, conveniently for the plot to make the suspense happen.
Right.
But there are times when it actually stops working, and it's a crap car, even though it looks when it's going out with style. No, it doesn't start when you need it to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, do you guys want to hear my pitch for the Northwest State Community College commercial that we should send out to everybody?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So, you start out with It's a close-up of the giant N on the water tower. I don't know if we have a ladder, but we should get a ladder. And then we have the president kind of... Huh?
We have a drone.
Oh, well, there you go. No, I'm saying a ladder for the president to climb down off of the water tower. And then he's walking toward the camera. And all of a sudden, you have the vice presidents coming one by one off to the side, matching him and walking to the same song as the end of Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah, and then after that,
you have the deans come in, walking behind him. And, I mean, you could stop there, or you can go with all the instructors, too. But having them walk and
then... You won't get faculty to show up to that.
No. But at the end, you have hashtag NSCC Proud, and they're walking past it this way, or off to the side.
Yeah.
And then you just keep it on NSCC Proud. But you keep all the same angles, you keep all the same music, you just change the actors, and you change the setting.
I don't know if we can get Thompson to do that little sprightly hop that Peter Weller does, which is awesome.
Don't give any explanation to it. Just put it out there, and people are gonna be like, what the hell is this?
That would be awesome. I'd have them march the Uptown Girl when they're...
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's how you get boomers to do that sort of thing. Anyway.
That's all I could think about when I was watching the end. I'm like, oh, we could do this.
Nobody in our administration is cool enough to deserve that and prove the wrong administration by watching this.
Yes, we'll leave that in just to see if we get yelled at. It's just a test. There's no real offense. Just a
see
test.
If they're actually listening.
Yeah, exactly. when these things get released, hopefully over the summer. I'm going to have to go through and listen to each and every one of these episodes all over again and enjoy it. I just sit and smile the whole time. It's a pleasure reliving these things with you.
Memories with your bestest movie pals.
Yes. Speaking of things I'd like to do with my bestest movie pals.
Oh my.
Should we segue?
You did. You just did.
Okay.
Peek at everybody now, here it goes.
Okay. I think that next episode, a bonus episode to wrap season two where we talk about superhero films, we should come in and pitch our own superheroes and our superhero team and our main villains and actually find some people to do a comic for us. I know that you all would love to have... Clink, we know you got a little paper sitting there with some sketches of a comic you want to do. Alan, I know you're nerdy enough to have some of that stuff laying around somewhere.
Yep,
I have a whole book.
Not to say, but not to steal from anything else you got going on. But, okay. And even if it just becomes, we get some of our illustration students to draw us a cover of our three superheroes, I think that's a worthy venture, and I would like to do that for our bonus episode.
Got it.
How long do we have?
Got a week.
Wait, okay.
You don't have to have everything, right? But like, I've got one. I've got a character name and kind of a little bit of a backstory. But like, I think we could talk about the universe of it. We could talk about some of the villains and some of the rules of the universe based on all of the stuff that we've done and talked about through for superheroes for the last semester. I think that's I think that would be a fun time for us.
Got it.
Cool.
And you guys thought it was going to be awful.
Hey, at least it wasn't. Let's rewatch all the bad movies from our time here, starting with Galaxy Lords and going to Black Scorpion and JLA 97. And
No. I'm never going to watch those movies ever again. I'm going to pretend they don't exist. So since that was such an easy thing to come to, let's talk about season three.
Yes, let's.
And what we're going to do for season three. I really like this idea of us alternating as we, each picking, alternating as we go. Alan, I think it was you that brought up apocalyptic dystopian-ish type stuff. What do you think in there?
So I was thinking that because we've already come across this a couple of times, I'm thinking apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic, and kind of pre-apocalyptic in the sense that things are going bad kind of movies. So dystopias, movies where things are about to fall apart, movies where things are falling apart, or movies where things have fallen apart.
I can't think of any movies that are about to fall apart off the top of my head.
Fight Club. We have a moment where we might be heading into something really bad. There's a lot of stories in that vein. The one that jumps to mind is Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, where society is just kind of winding down. Like, things are just randomly falling apart for no reason, by the way, other than people suck. And now the story is about people trying to overcome that suckiness in some key way.
So, like, so, Dr. Strangelove and How I Learned to Love the Bomb, would that be a pre-apocalyptic?
That's an apocalypse movie. The actual nuking happens at the end of the movie. So
yeah, that's the very, very end. So
yeah. It's on the edge. It's about the ending of the world. Another pre-apocalyptic one, I would argue, would be Natural Born Killers. But it only comes from a particular standpoint, which we will talk about on the show, because that is my third favorite movie, I believe. No, my second favorite movie.
Is what?
Natural Born Killers.
Oh, right, right. Nice. Would Falling Down fit into that pre-apocalyptic?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff about, like, the disintegration of a person kind of mirroring the disintegration of society. Again, I'd put Fight Club into that standpoint. Spoilers, but still.
Children or Men? Would that be a pre or a post?
Which one?
Children or Men?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I don't know. I don't know.
Technically pre, post, and not.
Yeah. Well, we can get into all this as we progress. And I'm thinking one of the things we'll always want to address is, so number one, what is this movie saying about our society now? And then how is this an apocalypse movie? How does this relate to to some of the movies we're talking about?
So I think too, if we're going to go, obviously we're going to talk about movies from the past, right? What was going on in those times that may have influenced it, right? Because typically what fiction is doing, right, is fiction is just a better way of calling somebody an asshole than calling them an asshole to their face.
Definitely.
So fictionalizing some aspect of it.
Cyberpunk. If we look back at anything about that's a cyberpunk style document, and there's very few movies that truly fit cyberpunk, but there's some. Mm-hmm. Cyberpunk is a dead genre. We're actually past the moment of cyberpunk now, because that was all about the 80s. Mm-hmm. And if you read Neuromancer, it's still an amazing book, but it's about a world that no longer exists. It's commenting on a world that has changed in some really key ways. It's like a period future. Mm-hmm. It's like watching something like Metropolis. It's about the future, but it's about a future that ain't gonna happen. It's about a future that was rooted in the 30s.
So. It's a retrofuturist movie, I love retrofuturist concepts.
Is it just an alternate timeline?
Yeah.
Or there's a bunch of stuff. So I think we're gonna get a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Maybe we can talk about Metropolis because it's a dystopian movie.
What are they?
Don't make me watch that movie again, please.
What? That's a good movie. They have a version that's got sound and color.
That's not the problem.
what are the criteria? Because you say apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic or pre. I'm one of the things I think off the top of my head is Episode 3 of Star Wars.
Okay. So let's say, and that would work, actually.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. We get to pitch, again, when we bring this in, we get to pitch what this says about our society or the society that created it. And we also get to pitch, again, how it connects to the series.
I'm going first.
Oh, God. What are you going to do?
Idiocracy.
Yes.
That's an easy one.
Yes.
And I think that will be a real easy one that can lay a foundation of all of the things that we're going to define things. So.
And it'll refer back to all kinds of stuff we can talk about too. Yes. So we'll have a big old sip of Brondo and get started on that.
I would vote we stay away from the obvious ones like 2012 or Armageddon.
Yeah, like dumb ones. I mean, we want interesting movies here.
We're gonna watch dumb movies.
I'm thinking,
but Interesting.
Off the top of my head, I'm hoping Ice Pirates fits into this somehow, some way. I think it will. I want to watch that movie again, dude.
It's up to you to make the connection.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right. So,
you have to have a connection in mind when you suggest it.
Oh, crap.
He's giving us homework. Like, we have to do research and reading.
Nope, you just have to have a justification. If you're good BSing, you're not going to have to worry about it. So,
I am. That's what I went to school for, so it's okay.
Yeah, you have a degree in art.
We're all good at BSing. That is.
How do you spell humanities? BS. Sorry, Sherry. See, we'll see if she's listening.
Prove us wrong, Squares. Yes.
All right, folks. Well, I don't have anything else. Do you have anything else? Or should we just talk about what we learned? Because I learned some things.
What was with the watermelon?
I don't even know. I didn't see that part.
All right. So who wants to start with what we learned?
I learned that this is very much a racial, stereotyping film.
Yeah.
All the characters, all the ethnic characters are stereotypes.
Yeah, and that kind of goes with the territory.
But it also does it with the white characters, though, too. Like Pretty Boy or Tommy, or whatever his name is, Tommy Boy.
Perfect Tommy.
It stereotypes everybody.
I saw that as it goes to the extremes of the characters so that they stand out. Unlike some of the other movies that we watched last season where, what was it? I was complaining about that one of the characters in one of the movies we watched last semester where they were too similar, so I didn't know who was who.
Oh, that was Galaxy Lords and the Clones.
Maybe. Well, no, the Clones or whatever.
No. Or even, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I cannot remember it.
Yeah, but there is a Netflix show, do not watch it. It's called Watership Down. It's about bunnies, and it's animated and about bunnies. Oh, it's going to be cute. No, these bunnies murder. They enslave people, the other bunnies. It's crazy. But it's...
That's what happens when you have overpopulation.
But a lot of these bunnies look similar. So you can tell by their voice, oh, this bunny's supposed to be this character, this bunny's supposed to be this. But they don't have very distinct defining features to separate them. And it's kind of confusing. All bunnies look alike. That's what I learned.
Speaking of stereotyping, now, Clink, what did you learn from this episode?
This episode or this movie?
Or this movie.
And just in general, yes.
Or in general, but this movie.
Yeah, it's COVID-19. We'll grade anything.
I learned two things. Dying means power. And that if I took a rock... All the things that make the rock up are like a trillionth of the volume of the rock, which then asks the question, if we know what the big Higgs boson particle is, which is the one that makes up the volume, right, that we discovered, why does that make up the volume? And why are things solid? Why can't I just pass through things if I'm not solid? These are more questions than lessons, sorry.
E equals MC squared.
That doesn't help. That's with power.
No, that's mass. It's mass.
Yeah, but what makes mass?
Light slowing down, energy slowing down to a speed where it becomes a solid.
Yeah, but if it's mostly air, like in Ant-Man, where they shrink, they just move the particles closer together.
Is that how Ant-Man works?
Yeah. Particles change the space between the atoms so you can shrink down, except when you go subatomic, it doesn't make sense, but whatever.
I learned that Clink's a nerd. Alan, did you learn anything?
I learned do not F with Christopher Lloyd.
Yes.
Notice that John Big Boutte just manhandles people in this.
Well,
I didn't quite process that Christopher Lloyd, he's decently built, so he's just wailing on people in this.
He's got some big massive fat fingers. You see his hands, like when they do him, Lithgow, and Goldblum are so tall compared to everybody else in this movie.
Yeah.
I'd love to see those three in a movie with Tom Cruise.
Oh, God. They'll have to act on their knees then.
Well, or get him three apple boxes.
Yeah.
All right, so I think we're going to wrap it up. It's been a phenomenal second season. If you don't listen to anything else, you'll at least have listened to this. If you're still with us. Bonus episode to come. Excited about that. Season three eventually. Dear Lord, we all need a break from this. And I got to catch up on editing. So from me, Mike Vanderpool, Mr. Michael Klink, and Dr. Alan Barris, this is and has been and will always be Because You Watched Whoosh! Oh, Star Crash.